study of history is a rather discouraging subject. But on the other hand, there is a great deal of constructive value to be learned according to the attitude of the historian. Those most people in reading, thinking, almost any other activity, work from a basic conviction of their own. And if they are pessimistic, they will find pessimism everywhere. If they believe history is nonsense, they can prove it. But if they believe that history could be very much like the human memory itself, the story of what we have been, where we came from, and why we are here, in some mysterious way, history at least gives us a clue to the intention of existence. So we try to understand the kind of people who came before and what they have contributed to us, so that when we become history in due course, people will appreciate what we've tried to do, or at least attempted to understand it, and may in due time correct a number of mistakes that we make. So history is an interesting thing, and Durant, I think, pointed out a number of these rather stimulating aspects of the subject. Now, as we look back over the pages of history, we find that further back we go, the fewer personalities emerge. Little by little, the history becomes a kind of blur, in which all kinds of people everywhere are doing things, and no one seems to have given much of a recording on the subjects. We just sort of fade away into antiquity, with just a few names shining out to the end, and then they fade away. So there seems to be a division in society. There have always been a few who tried very hard to do something right. There's always a larger group dedicated to preventing anybody from doing anything right. And then there was a third vast group that didn't care. And these three together, more or less, make and unmake the descent of knowledge. Now, we also have another problem. Progress is always dependent upon some kind of knowledge. And as we go along, the very foundation of knowledge are now questioned. We are assured that the things we thought we knew, we only thought we knew. And even the greatest truths that have descended from antiquity can now be questioned, and it is decided in many instances that they are invalid. Now, why is this, and how does it happen? Why is it so easy to reduce the wisdom that we have brought with us from the past? Well, I think that we must realize that nearly all ancient wisdom was in some way related to religion. Our ancient forebears believed in a divine being or plan that regulated all things. And this divine plan has been interpreted and reinterpreted in all parts of the world and in all of the ages that have gone before. So the question now arises, will have to be considered, is whether these foundations were true. These foundations represent mostly things held in common, beliefs believed for many groups of different backgrounds as valid, necessary, and important. And upon these foundations, the survival of our civilization up to the present time was made possible. Now, out of the past comes a very old, ancient, and universal concept, the Golden Rule, that we should do unto others as we would have others do unto you. Now, for centuries, this was held to be a valid contribution and appears in the systems of over 50 religions and philosophies in almost identical words. All over the world, people believed that. But back in those days, there were only a few who tried to live it, and there are still only a few trying to do it now. And as it becomes increasingly difficult to live unselfishly or constructively, we begin to find books and editorials appearing pointing out that the rule was never true in the first place. We were not supposed to treat other people as we hoped they would treat us. We were supposed to take them on, get all we could from them, and throw them away. This was the new rule. The only difficulty with it was it didn't work and led to one disaster after another. But all the way to the background of things, there were individuals, gentle, wise, kindly persons, who have tried to do things that were right. In very primitive times, the human being was not educated as he is now. He depended almost entirely upon an intuitive interpretation of nature and the world around him. He came to be very wise in the wisdom of the commonplace. He became aware of simple rules and became aware of the disasters that came when these rules were violated. And somewhere back in there, the beginning of morality was established. And down through the ages, it has been elaborated, interpreted, accepted, and denied, and persons have come forward to try and serve the growing need of the human family. So we know that we have a descent of learning, and that this learning is not mere superstition, that this learning is not all false doctrine, but that it has been abused. Someone will say, if it was so good, why are we in trouble now? Well, we only have to look around to see the answer to that if we think for a moment. We're in trouble now because though it was good, we never used it. We never were able to separate principles from our own personal appetites and desires. What we want comes first. If we can have what we want ethically, then that's wonderful, but rare. If we want what we want and we cannot get it ethically, we get it as we can. Now, this has been the way the world worked, but this doesn't mean that ethics was wrong. It means that we couldn't live up to something that was not harmonious with our personal selfishness and ambition. So we go back over these things and we try to understand a little about them. We also try to understand the fates of those who tried to bring us good things. And with very few exceptions, everyone who lived above the level of the commonplace of his time was seriously and disastrously punished. We know that one after another of the great leaders of human culture paid with their lives or their reputations for their efforts to help humanity. Way back 1,200 years before the Christian era, Akhenaten, the Egyptian pharaoh, sometimes referred to as the first human being of whom we have record. Then the sense of human as an intelligent Homo sapiens. We also know that he died of a broken heart, and according to some accounts, his death was hastened with poison. Years later, along came Pythagoras, burned to death with his school by a fanatic. We find Confucius, his last words, "I have failed." We find Lao Tzu completely disillusioned, riding off into the sands of Gobi on the back of an old water ox, going in search of that world where human beings and sages could dwell together in peace. Zoroaster, kneeling before the fire altar of his father, the great fire spirit, killed by a spear thrust into his back. Christ crucified. Muhammad poisoned. All the way. The great teachers were teaching something that humanity did not want to accept. Something that went contrary to the desires and, to a measure, the environmental pressures that existed. The idealist was always an isolated person or a very small minority of persons, surrounded by selfishness and greed, war and hate. And little by little, the old vices closed in, and those like who tried to teach us to do it better, like Bruno and Savonarola, were burned at the stake. So we have a kind of sad story of those who tried. And yet the suffering of those, as recorded in history, and what they gave us, these are the most priceless heritages that have come to the present generation. Now, long ago, when philosophy and religion were not divided, and both were in the keeping of the ancient priesthoods, there were many mysterious and wonderful symbols established, which have descended to us as mythology and legendary and emblems, heraldic devices, and all kinds of pictorial representations of universal truths. And in this great cycle of symbols, which were perpetuated and preserved simply because they were not understood, and therefore no one cared enough about them to destroy them, or perhaps simple readings, simple meanings, as in the case of Quarles in his emblems, were given, which did not really fit the picture, but made the picture seem harmless to those who did not want to be instructed beyond their own personal satisfaction. So there were all kinds of ancient ways of perpetuating these beliefs that have become so important to us. And perhaps one of the most interesting of all these symbols is the phoenix. This emblem seems to have two distinct origins, one in Asia and the other in Egypt. The Asiatic phoenix was a kind of domesticated one. There could be more than one in the world at a time. The phoenix pair, the male and female, appear in Chinese art frequently. They were the protectors and custodians of the mysteries of immortality. They were also associated with the secrets of the mysterious drugs and potions by means of which the sages perpetuated their youths. The phoenix was a very nice, pleasant, happy family bird in China. And he is pictured in art usually with a very beautiful, almost sublime appearance. No real bird could ever look like that. Even the peacock was a dim bird in comparison. On the Egyptian side of things, the phoenix was something that has been very difficult to analyze. It has much the appearance of the bird. It looks much like an eagle, yet it is not an eagle. It has a wonderful plumage on its crest. It has a very wonderful golden radiance around it. There is only one. There was no way in which the phoenix could breed. This is a very important point. For every 600 years, the phoenix flew to the altar of the sun at Heliopolis in Egypt, and there died in the flames on the altar, burned to death and incinerated. And in its death, it gave birth out of itself to the new phoenix. Its body burst open and through the flames, and the new bird came forth, born out of the ashes of the old. Now, it should occur to most people, I suspect, that this would not be regarded as the story of a real, honest-to-goodness bird. There's some other meaning implied here. And the fact that it is given as a symbol of resurrection is always an evidence, a representation of the new rising from the ashes of the old. Just as truth rises from the ashes of ignorance, just as courage rises from the ashes of fear, and just as intelligence rises from the ashes of ignorance. So the phoenix became the symbol of resurrection. It became the proper device to represent the eternal growth taking place forever in the created universe. There are many old drawings, types, and symbols of the phoenix. And one of the most interesting of the examples of it is found on the original drawing for the reverse of the seal of the United States. This seal is not the seal of an eagle, but gradually, through modification, it has come to take on the appearance of an eagle. But when it did so, it copied the eagles of Napoleon, the eagles of Alexandria, and the eagles of Caesar. These were something else, however. They were not the mysterious phoenix bird. Alchemy was probably the first group of system to recognize the mystery of the phoenix. And in most alchemical books and manuscripts, there are illustrations of this bird. The story of the phoenix is part of the story of the regeneration and redemption of all living things. It is also a symbol of the continual pressure of invisible principles and their victory over visible mistakes. So we go to the study of the cycle of the phoenix. Now, we can only study that part of it which is within the records of our recorded history. If we are to believe in the story of the phoenix, it goes back to the beginning. And if we are to consider its ancient meaning, it will continue on into the indefinite future. For the phoenix marks a cycle of 600 years, a very strange and wonderful cycle. And if we study history, we will see that this cycle is clearly set forth, and in a mysterious way, the presence of some mystical force or power alone can explain the great changes that occurred in each of these periods of 600 years. So we'll start with the earliest one that we can really find anything intelligent about, and that is 1200 B.C. This 1200 B.C. is the age of two great teachers, Akhenaten in Egypt and Moses in Israel. They came in the beginning of a year of the phoenix, or the cycle of the phoenix. Moses never entered the promised land. Akhenaten died on the altar of his deity, the Aton. Both of these were great picture people. They were great sources of tradition. Moses has descended as a living force into modern religion, and is one of the most powerful links uniting Christianity and Judaism. In the great religious buildings of Europe, figures, paintings, representations of Moses abound. And therefore, we must regard the Ten Commandments, which he brought with him from the flaming crest of Sinai, to be part of the great moral heritage of mankind. The Ten Commandments that up to this day have never been broken with impunity. The principles they stand for, we do not know where they came from. Moses certainly did not invent them. They either came from some mysterious internal revelation of the eternal, or else they arose from ages of unrecorded history in which human beings had to live with each other. Regardless of how we wish to approach it, the Decalogue is one of the great documents of all time. Also in this period, we have Akhenaten in Egypt, a frail lad, sickly from birth, a mystic, a psychic, a strange believer in ideals that up to his time were unknown. He is the first person to stand out as a completely human being and to reveal to the world a kind of wisdom that it was not ready for. All wisdom comes to those who are unprepared for it. Therefore, it has to struggle for its own survival. Akhenaten was a pioneer, a forerunner of many things. He was a king who never assumed any of the regent powers of empire. He was a king who walked along the side of the Nile with the farmer and put his hand on the plow that made the Kravitz possible. He was the one who is pictured in art with his arm around his wife, the only one we have in Egypt who is shown in this position and surrounded by his children. He was a father. And when he referred to his queen Nefertiti, he said, "My queen, who is myself." He is represented always as a gentle, kindly soul. He was also one of the first to advocate women's suffrage and to declare the absolute equality of the sexes. He is also the first to declare a strange kind of divine wisdom, the wisdom of the Aton. Instead of the worship of Amun-Re, Akhenaten worshipped the Aton and changed his name so it would include the symbol of the solar disk. And he represented God as the sun disk, every ray ending in a human hand to lift up the sick. Always the power of light to bring happiness, peace, plenty, release from ignorance and sorrow and fear. Always and forever, Aton emerged in Egypt as a deity of eternal love in whom hate could not exist. Akhenaten was the first pacifist. He gave his country and his life rather than to war. He said, "We are all created brothers. We are all equal in the eyes of the Aton. There are no strangers. There are only a one world population. All people are children of the same power. Therefore, our brothers." Now, this man was far ahead of his time. He was so far that in order to fulfill his vision, he had to stand by and watch his empire crumble. He would not fight his enemies, so they invaded his land. His love of peace was considered weakness, and he died as a person who was not brave enough to fight. The fact that he was a little better than that was not remembered. And those who came after him after his burial had his name removed from all the monuments of Egypt so that none would honor his memory. He had every defacement possible, and yet today, through circumstances almost unbelievable, Akhenaten stands forth as the great one among the non-Christian or Jewish peoples, although there is a report that Akhenaten belonged to a Semitic dynasty in Egypt. Regardless of that, he stands forth as the one of the pharaohs of Egypt, really worthy of respect. And on the basis or face at the bottom of his mummy case are the words in Egyptian glyphs addressed to Aton. It says, "God can call upon me unto all eternities, and I will not fail." So that was 1200 B.C. Now we go along for the next cycle. 600 years later takes us to the glory of Greece and to the greatest outflowing of wisdom at any one time in the history of mankind. For in the period between 600 B.C. and the beginning of the Christian era, practically all of the religions of the world received tremendous spiritual impulse. It was in this period that Pythagoras of Samos became the glory of Greek learning. He was the one to whom we are indebted to most of the secrets of mathematics, and his 47th proposition is one of the most famous mathematical formulas in the world. He was a great philosopher, a great mystic, and a great communal leader. He was one of the founders of the political system which we might today consider as communal existence. In this establishment which he founded in Crotona, a Dorian colony in Italy, all members were equal. No one was more than another. All shared their goods in common. All shared their beliefs in common. All rose at dawn to sing their hymns to the rising of the sun. Here was a great mathematician, one of the founders of music, the originator of the harmonic theory in music, one of the greatest physicians of all time, a great leader in reform of policy, who was a leader in practically every area, from cosmogony and theology down to botany and diet. This wonderful person was one who brought upon himself, as usual, the animosity of those around him. He refused to accept a rich man's son because the person was not morally fit. And in revenge, this rich man was able to cause a group to move in and destroy the Crotona Institute with fire and burn the master and many of his disciples to death in the ruins. This was the reward for progress, for trying to do something worthwhile. This was also the time of the last Zoroaster, Zoroaster Spitama, the one who brought these Avestas and many of the great secret and mystical writings to the world, and who tremendously influenced the Hindu theologies from almost every point of view. He was the son of the fire. He believed in the worship of fire. Fire was the visible symbol of the purifying power of life that took to itself everything and then kept the world clean because of its eternal vigilance. And while kneeling in front of the altar in the temple of his faith, the spear was driven into his back and he died at the altar's foot where he had worshipped so many, many years. He was a great counselor of kings, a great leader of opinion, but small, jealous minds found it easier to eliminate him than grow up to his standard of life. On the other side of the world, we have Gautama Buddha, one of the very few of the great teachers who was not penalized in some major way for his teachings. Buddha was penalized a little, but not much. He was not a martyr. He died surrounded by his disciples and honored. But in a strange, mysterious way, he also died of poison. Not because it was intentional, but because of circumstances which he knew himself would come. And the last words of Buddha were to his disciples, work out your own salvations with diligence. There is no other way. His teachings have probably had effects only less than that of Christianity. By numerical number, he was tremendously powerful. But he taught peace. He taught to serve the good, correct evil in yourself, and purify the mind. This was not an acceptable teaching then. And yet we cannot say that we've outgrown it. We can only say that we have not yet been able to live up to it. Buddha was honored, and the schools which he founded in parts of Asia are being revived now in this time of bitter conflict. And the hope of many Eastern nations is largely based upon the ideals which he taught. On the other side of the great waters, in the islands of China and Korea, there was another great teacher, Confucius. Now, if there ever was a socialist, it was Confucius.
And all the talks we have now about the mugwumps and the social equalists and the various modern groups. Confucius, 600 B.C., was the most important leader in social reform. And the Analects of Confucius, his writings, convey to us clearly the whole theory of life. He was the first to say that the entire structure of a nation is based upon only one thing, an enlightened home. The home is the foundation of world civilization. It is parent-child relation which must extend to all levels of existence. For in this world in which we live, the old is always the parent of the young, and the young in turn becomes the parent of a new generation. There is only one great archetype for nations, for countries, for continents, and for the earth itself, and that is that they are vast composite homes. And those who live well in a small home grow. And those who keep the home and keep the peace of the home have a light inside themselves that cannot be darkened by anything else. So Confucius made a great point of making a cooperative system of government based upon the fact that we are all part of one eternal family. That we are not brothers, we are not friends in the last announcement. We are the children of the eternal. We are the children of one divine force and power. And therefore, it is our proper destiny to dwell together in equality. The ruler is the right and privilege of service. It is the power of the ruler to do more for the common good. And rulership never exonerates the individual from the misuse or selfish use of his powers. As it might be expected, Confucius was not very popular. He was popular to those who knew him, but to the others, he was standing in the way of personal ambitions. So his last words before his death were, "I have failed. No prince has made me his counselor." So he passed on, and today throughout China there are shrines and temples to his memory. But in these buildings there are no portraits of the teacher, simply his name. And maybe in the gardens or lying around outside, the great rows of tablets upon which his truths were written for eternal time. One thing that Confucius didn't understand was Taoism. He was never able to understand Lao Tzu, his contemporary but slightly elder man. To him, Lao Tzu was like a dragon writhing in the sky. He was something unbelievably mysterious. A strange man who was born a slave under a tree in the orchard of his lord. He was a person self-educated, never went to school. He would have sat on the side of a hill looking out into the haze of China, and there he saw within himself or in the mountains or in the skies the mystery of eternal Tao reality, that which is forever the same. And he said, "Tao is the same thing as life itself. Tao is living, is humanity, is worlds, is the formation of things. It is like the rain. For the rain falls upon the mountains, gathers in the streams, descends into the rivers, and finally passes into the seas. Thus is the course of all that lives. But in the sea, the sun picks it up again, carries it back to the top of the mountain, where it falls again as rain. This is the cycle of existence. This is that which can never be changed. This is the forever flowing. And it is this forever flowing, this movement of life, this strange dance of life, that is the real mystery of human existence. That all things must in a due time and in proper time come to recognize that instruction is an inner mystery by which in due course the individual becomes aware of and united with the great motions of infinity. Lao Tzu wasn't very happy either. So in the later days of his life, discouraged and darkened by his times, the wars and strifes of his people, Lao Tzu sat on the back of an old water ox and rode out of the north gate of China into the great desert of Shamo, the desert of Gobi. And he went forth, according to his own words, to the fabled land of the immortals, where human beings live together forever in peace and in mutual usefulness and mutual thoughtfulness. And he never came back. So there was another one of these teachers about whom the mysteries of life go on and on and on. We also have others, for it was in this same period between 600 B.C. and A.D. 1, we had the great school of Athens. We had Plato and Aristotle and Socrates. We had all that glorious group. I remember here in Los Angeles when some years ago, extracts from Plato's Republic were published on the front page of the daily newspaper. The things he said, the beliefs he had, his concept of how to solve the problems of society. These were magnificent examples. He talked a language which only a few really understood, but those that didn't understand it were still deeply moved and inspired by the words. Also, we have a more deliberate and more cynical type of mind in Aristotle, who starts, however, his great essay on the metaphysics with the simple words, all human beings want to know. They want to understand. They want to have some securities of rich beliefs that cannot be overturned by the follies and fancies of the day. Aristotle himself had came to an unhappy end because he couldn't prove some of his own ideas. But he was a great producer of thought-producing material. And Plato and Aristotle and Socrates, the great Athenian commoner, are three of the Greek classical teachers who have been generally accepted by the fathers of the early Christian church and have never been declared to be heretical or untrue. They have been accepted and became the basis of religious education in Christendom for the first 10 centuries of Christianity. Other parts of the world were also producing leaders, people who could think through things. And in this cycle of the Phoenix, we have perhaps the foundation of nearly all of the great moral structures that are still functioning in our modern world. We are in the presence, therefore, again, of a few who changed the course of history, who set the whole world on a new way of existence. A way of, we might say, more or less social arbitration. A world in which man began to recognize his responsibilities to his world and to himself, and came to realize through all the great philosophers that we are not here to do what we want to do. We are here to do what must be done. And if we rebel against that, our whole life is endangered. Selfishness is the root of all the evils of our day. And this was the evil that was particularly emphasized in the Socratic, Pythagorean, Platonic, and Aristotelian schools. Then came the beginning of the Christian era. The phoenix bird was born again in the manger in Bethlehem. And a person was brought into this world who changed history for all time. The most powerful person who ever lived, the most important person, probably, who ever came to this world, poor, without any of the values that we consider as success, a person who was never understood in his own time and has been largely misunderstood ever since. A person, however, who taught one of the most important of all lessons, and that is peace. That peace begins in the heart. Peace on earth and goodwill to men. The whole system of Christianity was based upon peace. Love ye one another. Blessed is the peacemaker. Judge not, lest ye be judged. All of these thoughts were intended to provide the foundation for a new world order in which the old mistakes would be weeded out. And today we have in this world probably 1 billion Christians of various sects and denominations and various degrees of sincerity. But one thing is certain. They have a text that they have all accepted, the New Testament. They have all accepted the divinity or the divine inspiration of Jesus. They have accepted that the Christian way of life was suitable for the unfoldment and improvement of Western man. So let us remember now, blessed is the peacemaker. Blessed are those who do hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. Blessed are the pure of heart, for they shall see God. Thus was the message of the man who was rewarded by being nailed to a cross. So that was another great cycle of the bird. But in this case, again, the truth never died. The phoenix went back to Heliopolis to be burned upon the altar of the sun. But from its body, the new phoenix was born. And curiously enough, this brings us to the 6th century A.D., in which, in a mysterious and curious way, the new phoenix bird is closely associated with the rise of Islam. The dating is almost exact. And strange as it may seem, originally, Muhammad was very largely influenced by Christianity and Muslimism is Christianity in its basic factors. The prophet Muhammad was one who said and stated in the first line of all but one of the surahs of the Quran that the book was dedicated to God, the merciful and the benevolent. The original idea was to reform a corrupt faith. It gradually became the basis of a great corruption in its own right. Little by little, the fact that Muhammad never carried a sword in his life has been overlooked. Never mind what he did, the roles of the great caliphs came to conquer the world. And so we find another problem that arises in proselyting religions, the determination to conquer other religions. And in this very process itself, disowning their own spiritual heritage. And so we find this is again a great change. But what was this change? What did it really mean? How did it affect the world in general, outside of the Islamic sphere?